Hello, welcome to another episode of Everything is Canon, the Cinelinks podcast. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. In this podcast, we invite authors from all genres onto the show to discuss their latest books and novels, as well as just about anything else that comes to mind. If you want to reach me, there are several ways to do so, but the best way is to email me at steve@cinelinks.com, or you can always find me on Twitter at @everythingcanon. Today on the show, I'm talking to Travis M. Andrews all about his new book, Because He's Jeff Goldblum, The Movies, Memes, and Meeting of Hollywood's Most Enigmatic Actor. Travis's day job is a staff writer for the Washington Post, where he writes for the style and internet culture sections, looking at pop culture, music, movies, television, comedy, celebrity culture, and the latest trends on the internet. Because He's Jeff Goldblum is different from the usual slew of celebrity biographies and makes for the perfect coffee table book. It's a lot of fun whether you like Jeff Goldblum or not, as it's filled with a ton of behind-the-scenes Hollywood trivia and stories. We chat about all sorts of things, including a great piece he wrote about the damage inflicted when you have a QAnon family member. He doesn't, by the way, he just wrote about it. Celebrity culture in general, lots of movie stuff, and what's his deal with Jeff Goldblum. While this is a spoiler-free discussion, the odd minor detail may slip out, so if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled at all, better stop listening now.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. As always, around these parts, we encourage supporting authors and stories that affirm the lives of people other than ourselves each time we either engage in a conversation, whether it be online or face-to-face, or each time we participate in the market with our purchasing choices, and this should be done all year long. Today is the start of Ramadan, so I do want to wish not only our Muslim friends, but everyone many blessings in a peaceful month full of health and happiness. Finally, even though this won't air until later, I'm sending all my energy to the protesters in Minneapolis tonight. Please be brave, but be safe. Today in the show, we're doing something a little bit different than we normally do, but life is short. Travis M. Andrews is a staff writer for the Washington Post Style section, where he works on the pop culture team and covers music, movies, television, comedy, and celebrity culture. All good things, in my opinion. He was an associate travel and culture editor for Southern Living and a contributing pop culture reporter for Mashable and The Week. He has also written for Time, Esquire, GQ, The Atlantic, among others. He's here today to talk about his brand new book titled Because He's Jeff Goldblum, The Movies, Memes, and Meaning of Hollywood's Most Enigmatic Actor. God, I have a hard time talking tonight. If you can guess what it's about, then Travis will send you a free copy. Okay, I made that part up, but who knows, right? We'll ask him. Anyways, following in the historic Washington Post footsteps of Katharine Graham, Ben Bradley, Woodford, Bernstein, none of whom have been on this show, two of which are dead, please welcome to the show, Travis. Hi, Travis.
Hey, I feel bad for everyone you just named being mentioned in the same sentence as me, but thank you so much.
thank you so much for coming on the show. As always, during these times, I just want to wish you and your family, I hope you're all safe and healthy. That is sort of our baseline nowadays, isn't it?
Absolutely. You guys as well. What a year.
It's and just when you think it should be getting better, it seems to be getting a little worse. But hopefully with the vaccines going out the way they are, we were just talking off air about how bad of a job my country's doing. And, you know, you guys are doing so great down there. And I really am happy for you. But seriously, though, I want to do, it was, you know, half kidding, but you do work at the Washington Post. It is a famous rag. Who was the better Ben Bradley, Tom Hanks or Jason Robards?
Jason Robards.
Good answer, bud. Oh, I love you so much. We're going to get along just fine. As you can tell, all of my knowledge about your work environment comes from watching Grease. All the President's Men is one of my all-time favorite movies. And Jason Robards is so great. Did you see the Ben Bradley documentary? I think it was called The Newspaper Man.
I have it. I have it like queued up, but then every time I go to watch it, I just watch all the President's Men again.
It's really long, but it's really good. I mean, it goes into a lot of stuff that has nothing to do with the newspaper, of course, but interesting guy. I mean, interesting guy, complicated for sure.
Oh, for sure. It's so interesting to work in a place where, you know, there's some people there who did work with Ben Bradley. Well, so you kind of hear these stories and then you see it kind of reflected in media, but, you know, I'm a little bit younger. I didn't know him and never worked with him. I was there just for the Marty Baron era. So it's so interesting to just like hear these stories and then you watch the movies and all the different representations of him, and you kind of try to piece together, you know, what's actually, you know, real. What was he actually like?
Sure. But I mean, it is, you know, sort of an interesting thing because it is these are real people, they're not characters, and it is a famous historic news center. Is it one of those places that likes to remind everybody there of its past? Like, is there black and whites everywhere on the walls? And picture of Bradley sort of like, you know, with that foot up on the chair, you know, that shot of him, you know, cigarette hanging out of his mouth. Is it a company? Is it a business? Is it a newspaper that embraces its past? Or is it sort of, I mean, like, do you even go to the office anymore? And not during the pandemic, obviously, but.
Haven't gone since last March, but absolutely no. It is a place that absolutely embraces its past. In 2013, we moved newsroom, so we had the old historic newsroom that was, let's just say, left a little to be desired. It's what you think of when you think of an old newsroom, but right. You know, a little dirty, a little cluttered, and we moved to this beautiful new building, and it's a lot more open. It's a lot more spacious, more well-lit. And one thing they did is they added quotes everywhere. Mm-hmm. So quotes from Bradley, from Graham, all over the wall. So kind of everywhere you're walking, you'll see these quotes. And then we have these little rooms called huddle rooms where you can, you know, grab someone and go in there to have like a private meeting. And those are all glass, but on the glass is just famous headlines from the paper's history, which is cool. So you're kind of always reminded where you are when you're at the Post.
Right. Let's do a little, we were talking off air too. I was watching the BAFTAs earlier and crying during the, you know, memoriam shows. And, you know, this is sort of something you cover, right? Pop culture, entertainment, movies, film. What's it been like the past year covering this stuff for you? And, you know, what do you think of the job of these, you know, like these award shows have been doing, and just the coverage in general of these types of things? How's it been for you personally? And what do you think, what's your reaction to sort of how the industry's handled it?
Well, it's been actually a really interesting year for me. Because at the beginning of this, I actually moved to internet culture to fill a slot that we had. So I was still touching on pop culture, and I still do. I kind of straddle both worlds now, internet and pop culture. But I kind of think about things a little bit differently, particularly when it comes to the shows and the way they're being broadcast. I think that the Golden Globes was maybe one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Not necessarily in a good way.
No, it was a train wreck. And and I was looking forward to that. That's the one we all look forward to. I'm an award show junkie, not because I think they, you know, are yada yada. You know, we could have a, you know, philosophize all day on it. But I understand it is important to the industry, though. Some people don't realize how important it is to the industry. But I was just looking forward to, as a fan, you know, Tina and Amy back. And, you know, it's always a fun show to watch. And they tried something that just didn't work.
Absolutely. Yeah. But in a weird way, you know, it was one of the first ones that, because of the little switch I had for the year, I didn't have to cover it. So I got to watch it as a fan,
right?
Which is a totally different experience when you are kind of as looking forward to it. And then, you know, almost immediately people are talking and you can't hear them. And it's like, wait, what?
Yeah. Like happening? The very first award. Right. Yeah.
Daniel Kaluuya is speaking and no one can hear him. But in a way, I don't know. It kept me hooked. I was like, what's going to go wrong next?
Okay. The car accident thing, the rubberneck.
And I did like the looks into people's houses. There were definitely some weird shots. Like Aaron Sorkin was hanging out with just those seven or eight women. I'm not particularly sure who they were, but it was
his living room kitchen or something, right?
It was and then Jason Sudeikis just
the hoodie and mustache that was, we were talking about that one because I mean, you know, either he didn't get the memo or he just doesn't give a shit. I don't know, because everybody, like, if there was more than just him, it'd be like, okay, they kind of said play it casual. But he was the only one. I know, like, Bill Murray, I think had a Hawaiian shirt on or something, right? But
yeah.
Bill Murray gets a pass, let's be honest. But Jason was the only one.
And I think it was super late for him, because I'm pretty sure that he's in the UK filming the second season of Ted Lasso.
Right.
So it would have been like super late for him. And there was some speculation online that maybe he enjoyed a little something before the show.
Got a little high, right on. That's all right. That's why I like him.
Wouldn't surprise me in the slightest.
I wish he was back on this side of the ocean, though, because I love his, I always thought his Joe Biden was great. So it's hard to like, but that's a show. Ted Lasso snuck up on me. I just sort of like on a lurch kind of turned it on and ended up watching the whole season. I enjoyed it. I liked it.
I do too. And I love that it's based off like a commercial or a promo,
right?
Which just seems like that should not work. That should never work. And yet they managed to like flesh it out.
The BAFTAs were really well done, I thought. They no glitches really. You know, it was a mix of people there. They had Brits there, obviously, to present, you know, awards, and everyone else was on video from home and stuff like that. And it went pretty well. I don't know, about as good as I think you could do for a fully digital show, I think was probably the best you could probably do. So,
well, I always wonder, like, what part of the stuff will stick around. One thing that I've really covered in the past year is sort of the architecture that's just been built through the internet to have these sorts of things. And, you know, we're quote unquote going to supposedly resume normal life at some point. I wonder if that's true. But, you know, even if we do, I was thinking about concerts in particular. Like, mm-hmm. there are so many concerts that are live streamed. One of my favorite bands, The Holt Study, plays these, like, shows every December, and people love to go to them in New York at the Brooklyn Bowl, and they couldn't do it this year, so they live streamed it, and the stream actually worked really well. The sound was really good, and it got me thinking, and they played at the Brooklyn Bowl just to a new room, and it got me thinking, like, if you're in a band, why wouldn't you do this for every show? You could sell twice as many tickets, sell special merch or whatever.
You can still do merch, yeah.
Exactly, and like, so many musicians are doing that. It just seems like a great revenue stream, and I wonder how many of these things, this architecture will remain, from concerts to award shows, you know, people can't make it or whatnot, and you kind of have some part of it, you know, digital. I don't know. It'll be really interesting to see the kind of the lasting effects in that way in like 3 to 5 years.
I'm a big live concert fan too, and I'm also a big convention person, and you know, those will be the last things to come back fully for sure. But concerts is an interesting one, and you know, the thought of standing in a crowd of anything with that many people scares the shit out of me a little bit, but it'll be last to come back. But you're right, it's an interesting thing to see if, you know, if there's a business case to be made for sitting at home, because I mean, you know, the cost of touring on the band is ginormous, right? Mm-hmm. The overhead is huge for these bands. A lot of people don't even realize that, but you know, that'd be a big blow. I mean, like, my wife and I go to several each year, and we were just talking about our last live concert was this, you know, December 2019. We saw the Pixies, and starting to think, you know, it's a bit dramatic, but we're like, you know, is that our last show ever? Is that gonna be, it was a good show, don't get me wrong, but you know, like, it's one of those things where if you knew you were gonna die, would you want to know? And it was, you know, like, it's if that's our last show, I guess, okay, but
good. What God. Would be your dream last show if it had to,
you know? It's kind of funny actually, because it probably would be like the Pixies, but it would be like 86 87 Pixies, but tough call. Probably maybe like David Bowie in the 70s, maybe early 80s Bowie, or, you know, I'm a big punk rock fan too, so probably go back to, you know, 1975 76 CBGBs or something stupid, and see Television or, you know, Talking Heads or something. I haven't thought about that. Well, what about you got something that jumps right out at you, or?
Well, now that we're moving through time, that kind of changes things. I think.
Oh, a band that's still together right now.
Yeah, like Talking Heads Stop Making Sense might be like top of my list, just because I can't imagine.
Well, they would never get back together. They hate each other. Right. But yeah. As far as who's around now, yeah, I don't know, because we usually go see all the people that we like so much. My wife and I both, we like, you know, thank God, like a lot of the same music, and we. Like, anytime, like, the Pixies are touring, we see the Pixies. Anytime Black Rebel Motorcycle Club is touring, we see Black Rebel Motorcycle Club. Stuff like that. So, you know, we're pretty fortunate that way. And then, yeah, I guess it'd be, that's the thing. I kind of see everybody I want to see that is currently playing, right? So it's...
Right, it's like, do you have to go, like, I don't know, like, bang for your buck and pick, like, Springsteen or something, so you get 4 hours, or someone that's tougher to say, like, Dylan? Like, how do you...
That's it, eh? Like, yeah, you know, and that's the thing with Springsteen too. It's like, I don't think I could do it. I don't think I could do it. I don't know if I could do anybody for 4 hours, I'll be honest with you. Like,
I don't want to do most of anything for 4 hours.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like, when we go see a band, if there's more than one opening act, we're like, you know, it's just like, is there VIP seating? We're just like, you know, we're just can't stand for that long.
Yeah, I hate that I've reached the age where I call the venue and I'm like, what time does the band start?
I am the same way. Oh, I'm long past you there. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. You're right, though. It'd be interesting. Like, it's, you know, I mean, he's dead now, but I remember I was really bummed when Tom Petty died. I never saw Tom Petty live. That was a regret. Yeah, I don't know. Like I said, we kind of see everybody we want to see. So, Like, it's not like I want to go see Pearl Jam and Eddie Vedder have one of his three bottle nights where they play for like every, you know what I mean? Like, I just don't care that much about a band like that. So it's like when you're getting into rare Japanese B-sides, you're just like, oh, okay, I'm good.
I'm good. There's other things to do. Something's on TV.
Anyways. Yeah, I don't know, man. That's a good question. But because like I've seen every band I've wanted to see essentially if they were alive. So it's, but if they're just saying like, you know, you got one last kick of the can here, like, I don't know. It might be the Pixies, to be honest with you. I mean, they're probably my favorite band of all time. So why not?
Choice. Yeah.
You? Who do you got? Who's your?
I don't know, man. I'm spinning now. Cold Steady is probably my favorite band. So if I get one more chance to see a band, yeah, I might as well.
You want
to?
That's the thing. You want to know you're going to enjoy it too.
Yeah.
Right. You're not going to just pick, like you said, a group just because you know they're going to play for 4 hours. Like, you want to make sure, whether it's 20 minutes or 4 hours, you want to make sure you get your bang, right? So you got to go with a sure bet almost, don't you?
I think so. Yeah. I think so. If it's the last one, I mean, you for your last meal, you don't pick something that you've heard of and never tried. You pick something you love.
Understood. All right. Hold Steady for you. I'll stick with the Pixies. So let's do a little bit of personal history here. So give us a quick elevator idea of maybe, you know, not the Washington Post necessarily, but when you started getting into, you know, covering these types of things. And I didn't forget about what you just said about you've sort of moved over to internet culture and stuff, because I did read your QAnon article. It was very interesting. So maybe we'll touch on that, but give us a little history here first.
Sure. Yeah. No, grew up in New Orleans. And so just as a function of that, always exposed to the arts, music, et cetera. And I always loved two things. I loved books and I loved just the arts in general, music, movies, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wanted to write, but I didn't know what or how. I wrote fiction, things like that when I was younger, and worked at, you know, high school paper and the Lit Mag. And then I went to LSU and I realized that you could work for the student paper and make money and write. And that seemed like a pretty good deal. So I, you know, asked them if they needed anyone to cover pop culture. And they said yes. And so then I just did that for 4 years, and I just kind of really fell in love with it. I grew up reading a lot of cultural criticism, you know, Chuck Klosterman, people like that. Chuck Klosterman was really the person who I read and said, I want to think about pop culture like this. I want to be able to write about the stuff I love in a way that, you know, has me thinking about it a little bit deeper and a little bit more. And so I did that in college, and then I graduated in 2009. So there were no jobs anywhere. And so I did advertising for a couple of years, just freelancing on the side. And did a couple internships in journalism, finally, Washingtonian Magazine, and kept freelancing. Finally got a job at Southern Living covering travel and culture, which was not at all pop culture, but was a lot of fun. I got to take road trips all around the South and write about what I saw and what I ate and what I did. And yeah, that's pretty fun. And just kept freelancing on the side, covering pop culture, doing some criticism, et cetera, et cetera. And finally landed a job at the Post. That's the very fast version.
Yeah, that was probably a pretty good day when you got hired from the Post, I would imagine.
I will never forget.
Yeah, probably cried. I wouldn't doubt it. You'd be right to cry. I'd probably cried too.
I like blacked out for 5 minutes. I remember like sitting down, and the guy who hired me, this guy Fred Barbash, who's a legendary Post editor, and just great guy. And I'll never forget. He, you know, I answer the phone. And he's just like, so you want to work at the Post? And it's just like, you kind of just, everything goes blank. I don't know. I just like sank down.
You're like the New York Post? No.
Like, nope. Wait, be specific, Fred. I don't know where this is.
Please be the Washington Post. Please be the Washington Post. Yeah. That's really great. It sounds like it was meant to be in a way, because things, I mean, it's, you know, you had a couple of years there where you weren't sure what was going on, but it sounds like things sort of really fell in line for you. So that's really good. You just mentioned sort of, you're here, we're going to talk about the book here in a minute, but I really wanted to talk to you. You sort of mentioned it, how you moved away a little bit from pop culture just to sort of fill in some gaps at the Post, and you're doing internet culture stuff now more in a general sense. And, you know, you wrote this really great article about QAnon late last year, and pretty interesting. And back then too, it's, you know, I guess we knew some, but not a lot. I would, probably not when you started researching it. We probably didn't, in a public sense, right? Didn't know as much as we know now.
We were like on the edge of knowing.
Yeah,
I would say we were probably like a month removed from.
They hadn't blown up
really,
yet.
Yeah,
they hadn't gotten huge yet. Well, they were huge. We just didn't know about it. That's the scariest thing about these guys, but is how many there actually is. But
no, I think about it like the cicadas that are about to like show up in DC. You know, it was all very underground, and then like suddenly they all just kind of popped up.
Right. Yeah, like
a, but in a much, much more horrifying way than the bugs.
Your article sort of looks more at the damage, the fallout that having a family member fall into this QAnon stuff can have, you know, on a family and on relationships. What was sort of something that really jumped out at you when you started doing your research for this?
Yeah, the first thing that jumped out was I kind of put a call out on this this Reddit board on casualties. And what struck me at first was just the overwhelming number of responses I got. And again, like you said, like this was not something people really were talking about yet. People kind of knew QAnon at the time. I wouldn't say people weren't taking it seriously, but what was really thrown around the media was kind of the crazier aspects of the beliefs, the reptile stuff, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. So like to have well over 100 people reach out in like 2 or 3 days to say, here's my story, that really struck me. And then when I started interviewing people, one thing that really, really stood out to me, and you have all the crazy stories and the sad stories of divorce and mothers and children not speaking anymore and siblings, et cetera. But one thing that really stood out to me is how many people who had a family member who had kind of fallen down the QAnon hole, who said, one of the hardest things is I know how hard this must be for my loved one who believes this stuff, truly believes this stuff in their heart of hearts and feels like they know something so important about the world and can't get anyone to listen to them. And, you know, it's hard to have sympathy, particularly now, for a lot of people who have these beliefs, especially when they commit horrific acts. But there was something human in that really struck me. And the fact that people who were watching their loved ones slipped away still had empathy for the way that they must be feeling completely alone, that really struck me. And I don't think I expected that going in. I mean, I guess it makes sense, but a lot of times when people are telling me these, like, that's the part where they started crying. That's the part where they really broke down.
It's, you know, it's something I think about and bring up a lot sometimes when I'm talking with people when we really get into the weeds on certain issues. And, you know, I'm very, very pro-choice. But I'm always really good at sort of seeing the other side of the coin. And I remind people sometimes when they're getting a little too sort of, you know, maybe aggressive with their pro-choice stance. I'm just like, listen, these people, like, imagine you firmly heart of hearts with every fiber of your being believed, you know, that life begins at conception and then it's murder. And then multiply that by the amount of quote unquote murders that are happening every day. You'd be a mess, right? Exactly. Like if you firmly like, and I mean with every, I'm not saying they're right. I'm just saying if that's what you believe, God, what an awful place it must be for that person, you know, to sit there and have to think about that constantly and the amount that it's happening, sort of in a similar way with this person, you know, where like, yeah, they firmly believe this, you know, Democrats are, you know, drinking the blood of children and all the other far out there stuff. And it's so important to them and they want their family to understand that. And they can't.
Right? Exactly.
There's no middle ground to be had with an issue like this, is there?
No. And for a follow-up article, I actually interviewed a guy who was a like deep in the rabbit hole, full-on QAnon believer, who kind of came to his senses and no longer believes this stuff. And I was talking to him about it, and he was describing that experience. Like you truly believe this thing, and you're looking at the world, and you're like, how do I convince people? Which is one reason why I think it creates so much conflict, because then they want to bring it up over and over again.
Yeah.
Trying to convince people.
Right.
And I asked him, you know, what could have someone said that would make you stop in the moment? And he was like, basically nothing. Like people would just tell him, you know, that's crazy. That's not true. That's not real. And so he would just shut down. Like, but you can't have a dialogue. But he said the one thing that maybe someone could do is like try to hear him out. And that sounds so counterintuitive, I think, for, you know, you and I who know that no one's drinking any blood here.
Right.
But, you know, he said that was like the only way. And you know, that was just a really fascinating conversation that, you know, I don't think there's a lot of people who manage to kind of come back from that.
It's hard. It's listen, man, you know, empathy is in short supply these days, isn't it? And it's hard to have empathy for somebody, you know, when you hate them with every fiber of your being, and it's hard. I get it, because I'm there all the time, and I've sought help for it, and it's so hard. But you know, I don't know what the solution is. I don't want to dwell on this. I want to move on to the book's happier discussion. But one of the things that surprised me the most, I think, about that your first article on it was how many of the people were pre-QAnon were just not internet knowledgeable, internet savvy at all. Like, it's
100%.
Like, yeah, they went from like the dark ages to QAnon, basically, right?
Like, and I think that's like such an important component of it. You know, I think people have this misconception about QAnon. They think that it's, you know, these people who are going to 8chan and going to HUP and 4chan and these, you know, white nationalist boards and like looking for Q drops and all that. But I think most of the people who fall into this are people who don't really, they're not internet savvy. They're not really media literate. And maybe it's, you know, someone's, you know, grandma who finds a video, Plandemic or something on YouTube and says, well, that kind of sounds right. And then clicks the next video. And next thing you know, they're 25 videos deep, and now they're deep into the hole of QAnon without even realizing that they're into QAnon. And I think that is part of it that's been overlooked a lot, because everyone really cares, rightfully so, you know, who is Q, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the collateral damage is way, way larger than we think. And in my article, like, so many of the people that's got into it, they kind of sideways came in through a Facebook post or a YouTube video, and then you keep clicking, and you keep clicking, and it gets crazier and crazier, but it's like the frog that you put in a pot of water and raise, you know, 1 degree every hour and never realize it's being boiled to death.
Right.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it's one of these things that's been around for a lot longer than people realize. And, you know, folks have done their research now, like you, and you know, you seem to understand this animal. And I don't think it's going away anytime soon, but I don't know. Fingers crossed. I mean, ultimately, we'd like it to, like you said, maybe just sort of like slowly, sort of just like people will lose interest, you know, get older, move on, you know, yada yada. It's if they're, you know, if we ever find out that they're getting more recruits, then we're in trouble. But it's, you know, hopefully things dwindle. But
and I wonder if as predictions keep not coming true, if that kind of makes people. I mean, it could go one of two ways.
I always say that about any conspiracy theory. Yeah, it's my first thing I usually say to them. I'm like, has any conspiracy theory come true in the last 100 years? You know, point to one that has come true, and then we can have a good discussion about it. But typically, they don't have an answer because they don't. It's just not. They're not designed to have an answer. That's why, right. You know, by design, they start. You know, start at the end and work their way backwards, right? So it's a tricky thing to argue against. But anyways, enough of that. QAnon bad, Jeff Goldblum good. All right, because he's Jeff Goldblum.
I should have been on the cover right there. That should have changed the title.
How do you? Well, you don't know. QAnon could be your because he's Jeff Goldblum is a deeply researched biography, is hilariously funny, and offers readers both a rumination of fame and a dose of levity, ready to lift our spirits, engage our minds, and send us down a Goldblumy path of goodness. The book explores Goldblum's unusual but signature style and 20-plus-year career. Along the way, while learning about his lifelong love of jazz, his quirky fashion, his curious travel program, and his remarkable and unlikely Hollywood trajectory, the reader realizes that Goldblum didn't conform to the industry and the public conformed to him. Thanks to this sort of glorious age of technology and internet and all the other great things we've been talking about, and also, ironically enough, the downfall of a lot of newspapers, anyone can just Google Jeff Goldblum, right? It's all out there. A lot of this stuff's out there, right? So why should I buy this book?
Well, you shouldn't. You have the internet. You're all good. No, I'm
setting you up, man. It's your softball.
So here's what I always say. Yeah. When I sat down to write this book, I thought about that a lot. I think that more and more the place of the biography, particularly a celebrity biography, is I don't want to say it's losing its purpose, because that's certainly not true. And an expert biographer, I think, can paint pictures that other people can't. But I was not as interested in the biographical details, the stuff that you're going to find on the internet. What I was curious about is sort of, you know, we have in the title the meaning, which sounds maybe a little haughty, but I was interested in kind of the phenomenon of Jeff Goldblum, that this guy starts working in the beginning of his career with like these fantastic directors and then becomes this A-lister in the 90s and then somehow lasts another 30 years and becomes this very famous, I hate to call him a meme because he's not a meme, but he maintains his fame and in a way is almost more popular than he was, even though if you look at his, you know, career lately, he's doing good work, but he's not doing anything particularly on par with Jurassic Park. And I thought that signaled a lot about the way the culture's changed, about the way technology has changed, and about the way that fame has changed. And to be able to explore that through someone as fun, enjoyable, and as quirky as Jeff Goldblum, that seemed like a great way to Trojan horse this like bigger idea. So I think that's why you should read the book. And also it has haikus in it and a spot where you can write one. And that's kind of fun. So
it is a fun, you know, it's an interesting premise too, because he's not in it. And so essentially, you know, you want people to buy it to know, not just your opinion of Jeff Goldblum, because you do interview a lot of people in this book, a lot of big important people in this book too, but you're really, you know, banging on this idea that, you know, you want people to understand your point of view of Jeff Goldblum in a way, because you didn't interview him for this book, right?
Correct.
So did you reach out to him? Did you try and get him for the book?
Yes. His manager was very, very kind.
Yeah.
When he said no.
Yeah.
No, they were very, very kind and you know, wished me best of luck. And I reached out to many other people who I know, or sure, at least I believe that reached out to him and got the okay. In a way, obviously, I wish he had been involved in the book. It's hard.
Well, it completely changes it, though, too, right? Like, yes, in, right? It's a different book. It's a more standard, like you said, celebrity, you know, autobiography thing, expo, whatever, in a way, right? Like, it really does change it from, you know, this sort of fun coffee table type book that you've made to just something else.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in a way, if I had interviewed him, it becomes the book that I'm most interested in.
Sure.
I will, you know, openly admit, I am not a big reader of biographies.
Right. Neither am I.
Those details to me, like you said, they're on the internet. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, I find biographies to be filled with details that are there to sort of extend the biography's length than actually say something about the subject at hand. Sure. Or something deeper about it.
Right.
And I'm not saying I succeeded at that, but that is certainly what I was interested in. There's got to be something more. Why does everyone love this guy? And what does that tell us about us, technology, him, movies, et cetera, et cetera?
There's a lot of work in this book. How long did it take you to do it?
About a year. Okay. I'd say about a year. It started with a piece I wrote for The Post. So I had written that piece about a year before I started on the book. So I guess I had done a little bit of research, but really the heart of the work was about a year.
You know, we were talking earlier too, I'm 45. So Jeff Goldblum is, and I'm a cinephile. So, I mean, he's been in my life forever, my whole life. Cause he, you know, his first film was a couple of years before I was born, right? 70, 74, 75, yeah. Right. I was born in 76. I've seen 90 some odd, you know, high percentile of his movies, And he's not this again. I don't want to call it a resurgence because he never really went away. But his career at this point is pretty interesting. I mean, you talk about it in the book as well. You know, Thor Ragnarok, for example. You know, I thought his performance in that was genius, and I love Taika Waititi a lot too. You know, definitely helped him with that. There's a great line from him about "I want you to be yourself and I want you to improvise." You know, it's perfect, right? And you know, I hadn't done this in a long time. I don't know if I've ever done it ever where I've looked at the filmography of Jeff Goldblum. Pretty remarkable career. And he's definitely headed for Lifetime Achievement Awards of some sort at some point, but he's just so busy. He's still working all the time. What's your general impression of his career? Because it's weird because everyone knows him and he's iconic, no doubt. And like you said, with memes and all this other stuff, and each generation sort of learns to appreciate him in a different way. Mm-hmm. what do you make of his career?
You know, one thing I always say is that if you ask just your average person, not someone like you or I who were really into film, but you ask your average person about Jeff Goldblum, I feel like what I found over and over again, say, oh, I'm working on this book. Oh, I love Jeff Goldblum. I'd be like, you know, not to put you on the spot, but I'm curious, can you like name five movies he's in?
And yeah.
People can't really do that. They get Jurassic Park, they get Independence Day, maybe they get Thor, maybe they get Hotel Budapest,
yeah.
Maybe they get Big Chill.
Yeah.
And after that, you know, if they really know movies, maybe you'll hear Nashville or Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but most people seem to know Goldblum more as a celebrity than as an actor, which I find very fascinating.
Yeah.
So when you ask about my impression of his career, it's one thing that he says all the time in interviews, but I think is actually true. He always says that he's not a careerist.
Right.
He did what he was interested in, basically followed his own muse, which sounds really nice. And I'm sure, you know, a lot of celebrities say that sort of thing. And then you look at their IMDb page and you say, hell, your muse certainly brought you to the biggest movies of all time, one after another. With Goldblum, that's not the case. He could have remained this A-lister, I think, after the 90s and just chose not to.
Right.
And that's what really strikes me. You know, in the book, I talk about this, but for 30 years, he played a weekly jazz show.
Yeah.
Because he loved jazz.
Yeah.
And he's now put out two jazz albums in the past 2 years, but he could have done that 20 years ago.
Right.
You know, he had the fame, certainly. And I think it's striking that he didn't. And that, to me, really sums something up. The fact that he could have used his fame to put out a ton of records and probably sold a ton of records and instead just played this kind of intimate jazz show weekly because that's what he liked.
It's an interesting, yeah, I like the way you put that. And he always seems to have done it the way, you know, his way. You know, I don't know. I've never read anything about, you know, what it was like to negotiate with, for example. You know what I mean? I always admired somebody like Gene Hackman, for example, who, you know, worked for scale his entire life up until the day he retired. You know what I mean? Or somebody like Daniel Day-Lewis, who's just like, no, I'm good. You know, it's just like, you know, these guys sort of like, you know, did things, you know, under their own terms. And that sort of strikes me as how Jeff Goldblum probably has made his career choices.
Exactly. I think of him as having sort of a similar philosophy as Daniel Day-Lewis and just taking it in a complete opposite way.
Right.
Like instead of doing 9 movies and they're all very stately, Goldblum's like, oh, it'd be fun to be on Crank Yankers. Let's do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, and when I compare them, it's only in sort of just as far as how they sort of control their own narrative, right? Their own careers.
Yeah, for sure.
But Daniel Day-Lewis isn't doing some of those films. But what was interesting to me too when I was looking this up was because it just for some reason he just screams stage actor to me, and he doesn't have a ton of stage credits. He actually has way more TV credits than he does stage, and I would have thought that would have been the opposite.
Absolutely. I mean, he's done some stage work. Pillow Man, Martin Madonna's started on stage.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's how he was seen by Robert Altman on stage. And that's sort of how he got into Altman's early films, California Split in Nashville. The stage story that always strikes me is there's this little known, I don't want to call it a mockumentary, but it's not fully real. It's like a faux documentary that's also partially a documentary called Pittsburgh. And Goldblum's from Pittsburgh, and he was close to the height of his fame, I'd say, and he decides to go back and star in a local production of The Music Man and make a documentary about it. And when he goes to audition, well, first, you know, he didn't think he was going to have to audition. They go down there, and they're like, wait, well, he has to audition. And so he auditions, and the director kind of doesn't like him for the role. And I don't know, when you brought up stage, that just immediately made me think of that. The idea that, like, he was at that point very well known and would surely sell a lot of tickets. And in the end, you know, he gets the role and he does it well. But he seemed to really stick with film for the most part.
It's funny. And that seems like something he would have admired probably in the director or the casting director. It seems like something he would have probably went along with, right? Like, and he probably doesn't seem, he doesn't seem like the type to me. You would know better than I would. He doesn't seem to flex his celebrity, does he? Or
no, I don't think so. I think what I notice is the times when it does kind of come up is in ways that seem to be following the things he cares about. So, for example, he has like a collaboration or partnership with Prada because he loves fashion, and so he gets all these, you know, wonderful clothes from them.
Right.
Those are the times I kind of see the kind of celebrity flexing, but in the way you'd expect, no. Which is one thing that's so interesting about that Mock-U documentary. You see him just around Pittsburgh walking around, and like there's one scene where he's just on a bridge and a guy runs past him, he's jogging. The guy stops and says, "Hey, Jeff Goldblum, I used to strike you out in Little League." And they just kept running. And he seemed gracious and just cracked up laughing.
Well, he does seem like, maybe not everyday man is the right word, but he seems approachable. I feel like, I don't know, I've never, again, you would know, but I've never read any stories about, you know, somebody asking for an autograph and him telling them to fuck off, or he's never pulled a Russell Crowe and thrown a phone at somebody for asking, you know, or, you know, even on set. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say, on the autograph thing, one director told me they were together, I believe they're in Times Square, and, you know, a fan runs up and says, "Jeff Goldblum, a huge fan, can we take a real quick picture? Or can we take a picture really quickly?" And Goldblum says, "No, let's take our time." Did a whole photo shoot with
nice.
This guy. And like, that nice. To me is kind of who he is.
Right on. That good. That makes me feel good, right? Because, you know, I like him, and I, you know, I'm a fan of his films, and it's always nice to hear. I'm not naive enough. I've seen enough, read enough, met enough of these people myself to know what it's like. And I don't even blame them. I'd be pretty cranky too if you're getting constantly, you know, surrounded and bugged for stuff like that. What was one thing that sort of surprised you the most, maybe that either you didn't know or you're pretty sure the general public doesn't know about Jeff Goldblum, that you discovered, uncovered, I guess maybe is the better way to put it?
Surprised me.
Or that something maybe you knew, but knew that wasn't necessarily, like I said, widely known.
Yeah. So I think that it's a good question. I think that this might sound like a cop-out answer because it is kind of like in the book a lot, but I didn't expect people to like him as much as they did, which sounds crazy. You're writing a book about a guy, you think that people are going to like him.
Well, I was thinking that because you do interview a ton of people in this book, and it's like to the person, whether it's like even notoriously grumpy Harry Shearer, you know, like, right. Who didn't, Al Jean once called him a malcontent or something on the set for The Simpsons, like hates him, right? They hate each other on The Simpsons, but they're so contractually married to each other, they can never work apart. But, called him a malcontent or something. Just said he was poison on set or something. But yeah, Harry Shearer had nothing but great things to say. And that's going back to the right stuff, which was God knows how many years ago now.
Yeah, and they still stay, I guess, somewhat in touch. Harry puts on this show every year in New Orleans normally for Christmas. It's kind of an anti-Christmas show. And this year they did it digitally. And normally he has like local celebrities like John Goodman and Brian Batt show up. But this year he, you know, obviously they could have more people, and Jeff appeared in the thing. So they seem to still have that going. But yeah, like so many people, everyone, every single person, including like an ex-fiance, had nothing but nice things to say about him, to the point where I felt like I was being pranked at something. I was like, no one dislikes this guy. Like, there's got to be someone out there.
Right.
And that might be something that people kind of know, or at least get the feeling, but that was what really, really struck me, is how many people. And it felt good.
I was going to say it was probably a little invigorating, at the time. I don't know, however.
Certainly. You know. I mean, given, you know, the past few years, it was a nice shot of joy. Sure.
Right. And doing these things is a bit of a marathon, right? Like, and this is on your own time. You're working as well. So you would have done this in the evenings and weekends. And, you know, it's nice to know that, you know, like you said, that gives you a little shot of adrenaline, right? Probably when you need it once in a while, when you're like, yeah, you know, it's good because I'm tired, but you know what? He's a good dude. And this is going to make sense to a lot of people.
Exactly. But one thing that I did not know, this is kind of a small little story, but it runs throughout the book, and I love it so much. When he was in Robert Altman's Nashville, he plays this biker who doesn't speak in the movie. He just kind of drives around, and he's kind of a connecting character. Nashville, for anyone who hasn't seen it, is all these disparate stories set in and around Nashville, Tennessee, and to kind of get from scene to scene, we see Goldblum on his back. He never really plays into the movie too much more, but there's that. And for the role, Altman asked him to learn magic. So he learns all these magic tricks, and most of them don't make the movie. And so he's got this rope trick that he apparently would just show everyone he's met for like 40 years now. And every role he had, I can't say every, but nearly every role that I spoke to someone involved with said, oh yeah, and then he tried to do this rope trick in one of the takes. And we'd be like, Jeff, what are you doing? What's with this rope trick? And he would just say, oh, well, I thought I'd give it a try. I'm really trying to get this rope trick into a movie. And I just thought it was so funny that he just has this little magic trick that he just does for everyone. And finally got into a few movies. When you go through them, you might start seeing like,
oh, that's all I'm going to see now. Yeah. That's really cool. That's good to hear too. I'm not an Altman guy. Are you an Altman guy? I'm not an Altman.
I am.
Are you?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all
California
right.
Split, I think, let me rephrase. I am an Altman guy when Altman's on.
Okay.
When Altman's right. off, I want to throw my television.
Okay, understood. That's fair. The interesting thing I like that I like about, and they sort of some of the interviews touch on this, he's a chameleon. He kind of plays it just by being himself, though, but it's, I mean, he was like kind of a sex symbol for a bit, right? I mean, like there's, you know, you think of the shot in The Fly where he, you know, emerges from the pod and he's sweaty and he's in really great shape. He's still in a really great shape. The guy takes care of himself, no doubt about it. But yeah. But he's also like, you know, brainy and weird and then in Jurassic Park, he's cool. And but he's still, you know, a chaos mathematician in that. So like he's, you know, he's the cool brainy guy. Like it's, he just seems to have this weird thing with him where he's just so great at, you know, so many things. But the point I'm getting from your book and the interviews is that's just who he is. Like he's just playing himself a lot of the time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It is interesting when you see pre-Fly movies where he's still kind of the skinny kid.
Right.
He's 6'4", and it's very funny. I was interviewing Phil Kaufman, who directed Invasion of the Body Snatchers and The Right Stuff. And he, at some point, just
which must have been great, by the way, for you. I would have liked it.
Yeah. I was over the moon. I was just like, I can't believe I'm talking to Phil.
Yeah. How was his memory on that stuff? Good or?
Oh, really good.
Was it?
Really good. But it was so funny because at one point he just made a very pointed. He made sure that he told me that he liked skinny Jeff Goldblum and he wished he hadn't gotten buff, which I thought was hilarious.
Isn't that funny? But it's true though. But not everyone like, I mean, that's the thing. And once you know that body's under there, but nobody, it's not something that was sort of used necessarily in later films, but he was like, he was kind of had a leading man thing going for a bit. And then but even in like, you know, Independence Day, he's the nervous science guy or, you know, or whatever. And it's very strange. So that's one of the things I really enjoyed about, you know, seeing him in like Grand Budapest and these things like this, where he gets to play something even different. That's anything we've seen him do before. And I mean, I just can't imagine a better sort of like set of direct, you know, Taika Waititi, Anderson, you know, these types of directors are perfect for a Jeff Goldblum, aren't they?
Especially like, at this point in his career,
right? Like you could almost, it's almost too good, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that one thing that they do that's really interesting is they play on his persona to some degree.
Right.
You know, that's one thing I talk about in the book and I think about a lot is like he, you know, back then in the 90s when, you know, The Fly, all that, he was doing what Sean Finnessy told me was like he kind of created the archetype of like the sexy scientist.
Yeah.
You fill in scientists with other roles of sort of, you know, intellectual roles. He plays teachers, journalists, scientists, but he plays these kind of same roles over and over again, doctors, and he brings that energy. And then he becomes this person who's so well known for kind of his persona and the you know, like we talked about with the memes and everything. And I think that Taika and Wes Anderson really knew how to take that and play with it on screen because Jeff Goldblum's the kind of guy who, when you see him in a movie these days, it would take something pretty major.
He has that problem now where if you're around long enough and you're big enough, you become bigger than the characters you play. It doesn't matter what Tom Cruise does. You just see Tom Cruise.
Right.
Or maybe Ethan Hunt. Maybe just some people probably think he's Ethan Hunt in real life. I don't know. But, but like, you know, it's like, you know, I think of something. I remember it was like watching, you know, like Gravity or something. And everyone's like, that's, I'm like, no, it's just, all I see is like, anytime he talks, it's like George Clooney, mm-hmm. George Clooney. Like, you just can't, he's bigger than any real, you know, Tom Cruise is bigger than any real life famous person.
Right.
When you
his celebrity
is bigger than anybody that he could play, save maybe Superman or something, right? Like, you know, we're talking all time here, and Goldblum's like that, but that's why I really, you know, applaud things like how Taika handled him and stuff, you know, and Thor and stuff like that. It's like, of course you've got to dress him up, you know, and, you know, make him do something, put him in a slightly different environment maybe than he's used to, and that's as good as you're going to get. But it is true. Yeah, he's at the point now where there's no escaping it. So unless you're going to put I guess you could just cover him with a mask or a prosthetic or something, but that's not why you're casting him either, are you?
Right. How mad would the audience be if they showed up and then he was like playing it serious or straight down the middle as like the bad guy in a Marvel movie? People would be, it would miss all the appeal. And I think that's what those guys have done so well with them is, and it's say, okay, we know why people like him. Let's play with that.
His dialect too, right? Like there's nobody that sounds like Jeff Goldblum. There's nobody that talks like Jeff Goldblum, right? That's why he's great on anytime he does a voiceover too. Like right away, you're like, that's Jeff Goldblum. And you just, you know, it's almost, he's a weird thing in a way where it's like, you know, he's a character himself, but he's been around for so long, we know better. You know what I mean? We know that. And then we hear things about his jazz escapades and his, you know, his fashion stuff. And you realize there's more to him. He's a three-dimensional, you know, well-rounded person, but it sort of brings it all together and makes this, you know, this aura, this Jeff Goldblum thing. And that's really, I mean, one of the great things about this book is that it's all encompassing. One of the really fun things I like about this book too is, you know, you sort of zero in on some of the smaller things too, right? It's, you know, we could talk about the Jurassic Park set and things like that all day, of course, but, you know, I love that section where you have your ranking sort of like the most fanatic Jeff Goldblum fans, you know what I mean? And although it's too easy to give it to someone like Conan O'Brien, who's got the connections and the money.
Yeah, right?
That's that list. Actually, although you play it, it should be reversed. I think you should have given it to the person who had to work the hardest. But you know, I love the one story about, you know, he showed up at the Pittsburgh event.
Yeah, Jeff Goldblum Day.
The Jeff Goldblum Day, right? You know, stuff like that. That's, you hear stuff like that, and you know he's from there, of course, so it makes sense. But at the same time, it's like that, you hear stuff like that, you're like, that's pretty cool. And you know, it really makes you remember that he is just a, you know, a good, decent guy who just really seems to enjoy life, and what's wrong with that?
Exactly. I think that's well put. He truly seems to enjoy life in every aspect, and that's like, I don't know, that's aspirational in a way to me.
To be an iconic actor?
Yeah. To be an iconic actor, make tons of money, put out records, you know, and then somehow find a way to enjoy life while doing
it. No, and that's it, right? Like it's a thing because he's managed, again, we'll get you out of here, but he's managed to avoid this hysteria though, too, part of it, right? Like, because he's as big as he is, he's not, I'll just say Tom Cruise because we already said it, but you know, he's not Brad Pitt. He's not, you know, these guys that don't have this, you know, I'm sure he has fanatical fans, but there isn't this, maybe because he's sort of lived a controversy-free life for the most part. You know what I mean? He hasn't been wrapped up in any scandal or anything like that. And everyone does like him so much and no one has a bad thing to say about him. It's like, it's not that he's boring. It's just, he's not scandalous enough for the masses, the media particularly, to pay attention to, is he?
No, and I think that
that's a sweet spot to be in for him, isn't it, though?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's perfect.
Yeah.
And I think that this will sound paradoxical, but like, I feel like he's managed to maybe intentionally stay somewhat out of the spotlight while maintaining a level of notoriety.
Yeah.
You know, you think about someone like Brad Pitt, and you know, he is when he has big movies coming out, or really any movies, you know, he's doing tons of press. He's out there. He's doing things like, you know, hugging his ex Jennifer Aniston, and it becomes tabloid fodder.
Right.
Goldblum's kind of, he has his Instagram and he uses that, and then he just kind of otherwise stays out of the media,
right?
In a way,
right?
Which I think makes him more mysterious, and then people care about him all the more because
it adds to the enigmaticness of it, the whole thing for sure. Yeah, the whole mysterious part of it, but yeah, no, it works for him, and like I said, there's not a thing wrong with that. Good for him too, because he seems to have like we talked about controlling his career. He's controlled his persona. Mm-hmm. It seems like too. So either that, or he's got a really great team of publicists. Yeah. who knows what the truth is? That'll be the next book.
Yeah.
Listen, I can't thank you enough. This will air after the book is out, just after. So I assume you're happy with them buying it, however they can get their hands on it.
Absolutely. Support your local bookstore if possible.
Yep. Bookshop.org is always a good one if you don't have any local indies in your area. We don't want to support that pandemic profiteer if we don't have to. But if you have to, you have to pick up this book. It makes a great, great conversation piece. It is a coffee table book in every truest sense of the word. And it's a beast. It's a big book. And there's a ton of stuff in it. And the work is on the page. And congratulations, because you can tell you put a lot of work into this thing. And it shows, and it's really a lot of fun. And, you know, even if I think whether you're a Jeff Goldblum fan or not, I think there's enough in there for just anybody who enjoys, you know, pop culture for sure, but just movies in general. You do a lot of great, there's a lot of great sort of like, you know, anecdotal trivia, you know, stuff in there, and, you know, getting to go talk to these, a lot of these great directors and behind the scenes stories. And there's some really great stuff in this book. And I think there's something for everybody if they give it a shot. So I highly recommend it.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, Travis, I really appreciate you taking the time, and continued health and safety for you and yours. And I don't know, any more QAnon articles coming out?
I think for now I'll take a step back.
You're going to cool it on the QAnon.
Focus more on the Goldblums of the world.
You were starting to agree with them. You're like, I got to get it. I got it. It's time to go. All right. Well, continued success, and we'll talk to you again soon.
There you have it. Another episode of Everything is Canon all wrapped up. Huge thanks to Travis for taking the time to chat with me today. Because he's Jeff Goldblum is a lot of fun and would make for a great addition to the coffee table stack. If you want to pick up a copy, which I suggest that you do, head on over to travismandrews.com to order one today. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen, and head on over to cinelinks.com for the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Please continue to be safe out there. Bye for now.